Go ahead and turn your Bibles to the book of Daniel. We'll be studying from there throughout the lesson this morning. I'll start here before the lesson begins by saying that we'd really like to echo what David said earlier when he began the song service. That is that we are very thankful to see so many of you back this morning. I had a pretty good idea about who might be here today, and quite frankly, I was looking forward to seeing you. And we do appreciate you being here. Wish we could see you more often. The book of Daniel, if you read through it, and you don't necessarily even have to read that deeply. I don't recommend that, of course. It's good to read it and read it deeply and study it carefully. But if you just simply read through the book of Daniel, I believe you'll reach this conclusion without any doubt, and that is indeed a very fascinating book. And what we're going to do this morning is just look at some of the reasons why this book is so fascinating. I have recently been studying it anew. I've tried to sort of give it fresh eyes and I guess in a manner of speaking, just sort of start from scratch. Sometimes I just throw away all my old notes and say, well, you know what, I'm just going to start all over again. And that's basically what I have done. And it has been a tremendous encouragement to me. Again, I have found the book in many ways to be fascinating. Here's one reason why. In the book, we have four young Jewish men taken into Babylonian captivity. Taken so they can be trained in the court of an infidel king. Of course, Nebuchadnezzar was the king at this time, but not only are they going to serve in the court of that infidel king, they will serve in the court of infidel kings that will follow him. The plan is to completely immerse them in the way of the Chaldeans. And of course, the way of the Chaldeans, in many instances, of course, would be very much counter to the ways of God they had been taught in the law of Moses. And so this is a critical time for Daniel and for Shadrach and for Meshach and Abednego. But of course, as we read the book, we understand that these young men did not forget who they were or whose they were. They did not forget the one whom they served. Let's look at just a few examples of that. And I know many of you are familiar with these accounts. But in chapter 1, verse 5, and the king appointed for them, that is for Daniel and his three friends, the king appointed for them a daily provision of the king's delicacies and of the wine which he drank. 3 years of training for them, so that at the end of that time they might serve before the king. Then down in verse 8, But Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's delicacies, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore, he requested of the chief of eunuchs that he might not defile himself. It's hard to say exactly how old Daniel and these other men were. I believe good estimates, at least, would place them somewhere around 16 to 20. And so we have some 16 to 20s here. And so you just imagine yourself in the very same situation. You are far, far, far away from home. And you've got this kind of pressure from the palace. You've got this kind of pressure from people who really have the power of life and death over you. And they're saying, here's what you're going to have to do. Would you have been as strong as Daniel? And not only Daniel, but as we keep reading the account here, we see that not only was he resolved not to defile himself, the same was true of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. In fact, Daniel went to the steward. He says, okay, let's do a little test here. We don't want to do this. If just give us vegetables for 10 days. And at the end of 10 days, if we're okay, if we're looking good, then can we just drop this whole thing? Of course, you know how it worked out. They took the vegetables for 10 days. They examined Daniel and his three friends, and boy, their features were a whole lot better. I mean, they were doing so much better than all of the other people. God, of course, was with them through this entire process. But think of the great resolve. Be impressed by the great resolve that these men had. And then, of course, concerning Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in particular, in chapter 3, beginning with verse 14, you remember the account here, how Nebuchadnezzar had erected this great statue of gold and everybody was to fall down and worship before this image when they heard the sound of all of these various instruments. And of course, when the instruments played, everybody bowed down, didn't they? Except for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And we see there in verse 13 that Nebuchadnezzar is enraged about this. And what he decides to do is what? You remember? I'm going to give you another chance. We're going to go through this again and you'll have another opportunity to fall down and worship. All right, so let's pick up the reading in verse 14. Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying to them, is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the gold image which I have set up? Now, if you are ready at the time you hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery, and symphony with all kinds of music, and you fall down and worship the image which I have made, good. But if you do not worship, you shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning, fiery furnace. And who is the God that will deliver you from my hands? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If that is the case, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning, fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand, O king. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up. We believe our God is able to deliver us from this furnace. But we also consider the fact that this may not be his will. Even if he should decide to let us perish in this fire, I want you to know that we are not going to worship this image. Now that's strong faith, isn't it? Again, let's be impressed with the resolve that these men had. Over in chapter 6, back to talking specifically now about Daniel. In chapter 6, again, you're familiar with what happens here, right? You've got these envious men, people who are envious of the high position that Daniel has been given, and they are looking for anything they can find to use against him. And so they get to studying all of his administrative affairs, and they just can't find a thing. They can't find any fault in the way that he has administered his responsibilities in this kingdom. Imagine that. And so they come to this conclusion. You know what? It's going to have something to do with his service to God if we're going to get it. And so they encouraged the king to pass this decree, right? Whoever petitions any god or any man besides you, O king, he will be thrown into the den of lions. And of course, the king is obviously going to be flattered by such a thing, and he, of course, establishes a decree. Well, how did Daniel react when he knew that the decree had been signed? He just trembled in fear, didn't he? Well, I guess I'll have to change what I'm doing. Now, here's how he reacted in verse 10. Now, when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went home. And in his upper room, with his windows open toward Jerusalem, he knelt down on his knees three times that day and prayed and gave thanks before his God, as was his custom since early days. Didn't change a thing, did he? I am going to continue to pray to God no matter what this decree says. I must obey God rather than man. So again, try your best to put yourself in the place of all of these men and be impressed with just how strong their faith was, how much courage they showed. In fact, as we look through the book as a whole, I've tried my best to, in regard to Daniel in particular, just point out all of the different qualities that we see in Daniel throughout the entire 12 chapters. If you want to see humility in action, read this book. If you want to see faith and courage in its finest form, read this book. If you want to find somebody or see somebody who really loves his people, his brethren, read this book. If you want to see someone who has the utmost integrity, someone who was able to maintain his convictions and yet still show respect for those in authority, read this book. If you want to read about somebody who prayed often and prayed fervently to God, read this book. If you want to see someone who studied the Bible, along with all of that praying, read this book. I think the phrase that pretty much sums up God's estimation of this man, three times Daniel is described as one greatly beloved. Daniel was greatly beloved by God. Now, does that phrase or that word beloved in particular ring any bells? Remember at Jesus' baptism, this is my beloved son. And I'm not, of course, saying Daniel had any qualities of deity or anything like that, but that's what God was saying concerning Daniel. This is my beloved son. What a great book. What great men we read about in this book. What heroic deeds of faith and courage we read about in this book. Here's another thing that to me stands out and makes the book so fascinating. We mentioned those infidel kings before whom these men would serve. We see these same infidel kings offering praise to the one true and living God. Goodness, we even see them issuing edicts, exalting God, and giving commands throughout the kingdom as to how people should regard God. Let's look at some of those. Look in chapter 2. After Daniel has revealed to Nebuchadnezzar both his dream and the interpretation of it, here's Nebuchadnezzar's response beginning in verse 46. Then King Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face, prostrate before Daniel, and commanded that they should present an offering and incense to him. Of course, that's not what Daniel's all about. The king answered Daniel and said, "Truly, your God is the God of gods, the Lord of kings and the revealer of secrets, since you could reveal this secret. Then the king promoted Daniel and gave him great many gifts and made him ruler over all the province of Babylon and chief administrator over all the wise men of Babylon. Now don't be mistaken here. Nebuchadnezzar hasn't turned into a believer. He hasn't disavowed all the idols that he has served or anything like that. And yet he is impressed with the God of heaven. The God of heaven and earth, the only true God, and offers praise to that end. But it's going to get even better. Look in chapter 3 and verse 29. This is what Nebuchadnezzar does after Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego have refused to bow down to that image. Of course, we know that God delivered them from this fiery furnace. Verse 29. Therefore, I make a decree that any people, nation, or language which speaks anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, and their houses shall be made an ash heap. For there is no other God who can deliver like this. Now, remember, this edict is being distributed all throughout the kingdom. Regardless of how much progress Nebuchadnezzar may make in his convictions about the one true God, imagine the potential impact that this has on all the different people throughout all of the kingdom who receive this. Think about the knowledge of God that is spread because of this edict and ones like it that we'll read. Look in chapter 4. Chapter 4, you remember Nebuchadnezzar had a pretty difficult time there for a while. God had to humble him because of his great pride. In fact, there in verse 33, just to kind of get a little glimpse of what was involved in that humbling process, that very hour the word was fulfilled concerning Nebuchadnezzar. He was driven from men and ate grass like oxen. His body was wet with the dew of heaven, till his hair had grown like eagle's feathers, and his nails like bird's claws. So just picture that for a minute. And at the end of the time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes to heaven, and my understanding returned to me. And I blessed the Most High, and praised and honored Him who lives forever. For His dominion is an everlasting dominion, and His kingdom is from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing. He does according to His will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. No one can restrain His hand or say to Him, "What have you done?" Down to verse 37. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, all of whose works are truth and His ways justice. And those who walk in pride, He is able to put down. Be hard for me to offer a better tribute of praise than the one offered by Nebuchadnezzar here. Some of these words of praise that we've already seen, even going back to what Nebuchadnezzar said back in chapter 2, if we just isolated these words of praise and we didn't know who was saying them, and we presented these to somebody, somebody might get the impression, well, that sounds like the words of an overzealous Christian somewhere. But no, these were words coming from infidel kings. And you know why they said these words of praise to God? Because they had evidence right in front of their face that they could not refute. There was no other way they could explain these things. They were left with no other choice but to offer this praise to God. What a powerful testimony from these heathen kings. One other example in chapter 6. In chapter 6, beginning with verse 25, that King Darius now. King Darius wrote to all peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied to you. Of course, this is in the aftermath of Daniel delivered from the mouth of the lions. I make a decree that in every dominion of my kingdom, men must tremble and fear before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God and steadfast forever. His kingdom is the one which shall not be destroyed, and his dominion shall endure to the end. He delivers and rescues, and he works signs and wonders in heaven and on earth, who has delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. Isn't it fascinating to see these kings who were very much prior to all of this opposed to God and to everything associated with God, the furthest thing from their mind, at least initially, would have ever been saying the things that they wound up saying. And yet, as we've already said, in the face of all this evidence, that's exactly what they do. Something else fascinating about the book of Daniel, we've already seen some indication of that in some of these words of praise. We have the rise and fall of four empires, that is, kingdoms of men foretold. First of all, there's Babylon. Well, really specifically, the fall is foretold because it's actually the one that is in power at the time Daniel begins his work. But then we read about how Medo-Persia would come after Babylon. And then, of course, the reign of Alexander the King, the Great, and began the Grecian kingdom. And then finally, the kingdom of Rome. But of particular interest to us, though, is the rise of another kingdom, a kingdom which could never be destroyed, a kingdom that would be established, as we see in the book itself, in the days of the Roman Empire. Look in chapter 2. We referred earlier to that dream that Daniel had revealed and interpreted for Nebuchadnezzar. In Daniel 2, beginning in verse 44, "And in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. And the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. Inasmuch as you saw that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it broke in pieces the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God has made known to the king what will come to pass after this. This dream is certain, and its interpretation is sure." And then over in chapter 7, beginning with verse 13. What a beautiful vision Daniel is given here. In chapter 7, beginning in verse 13, "I was watching in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven. He came to the Ancient of Days. They brought him near before him." So we see the ascension of Christ back into heaven, right? Verse 14. "Then to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away. And his kingdom, the one which shall not be destroyed." And so one of the great messages in the book of Daniel is that the kingdoms of men rise and fall. kingdoms of men come and go. And you better make sure that you have something to hold on to besides these kingdoms. You better have something much more secure, something much more steadfast, because these don't last forever. But you can be part of something that cannot be shaken. You can be part of something that shall never be destroyed. And thanks be to God, those of us who are His children, we are part of that kingdom. It doesn't matter. Whatever we're a part of, we're citizens of the United States. You think the United States, at least in its present form, will last forever? Very doubtful, isn't it? But we are part of something that will last forever. Think of the strength, the security, the consolation, the encouragement, the comfort that that provides to us. We are His. We are His. And we will forevermore be His. He will look after us. He will take care of us. He will preserve us. We are His. We are children of the King. And that's one of the great messages here. Another reason why the book is so fascinating. But also foretold is the rise of certain kings within these empires. Kings who would persecute God's people. Kings who would stand in opposition to God and to the establishment of His kingdom. What do you suppose God does about that? If you've already read the book, you know, but I don't think you even have to read the book to know what's going to happen to these guys, right? That's part of this whole thing. We're talking about the security of being part of this kingdom. Here are people who are lining up against God. No, this ain't going to happen. I'm going to bring everything you're trying to do down. What do you suppose God does about those people? Well, let's look at a couple of examples. In Daniel chapter 8, we have a certain king that would arise during the time of the Grecian Empire, after it was split by Alexander the Great. And let's just read about this particular king, beginning in verse 23. And in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors have reached their fullness, a king shall arise having fierce features who understand sinister schemes. His power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. He shall destroy fearfully. He shall prosper and thrive. He shall destroy the mighty and also the holy people. Sounds pretty ominous, doesn't it? And it is. Through his cunning, he shall cause deceit to prosper under his rule. And he shall exalt himself in his heart. He shall destroy many in their prosperity. He shall even rise against the prince of princes. But he shall be broken without human means. He's going to come to an end. And if you read the entire vision, you see a little bit more detail concerning that. He is going to have his way for a while, but he will be brought to an end. Now, in chapter 7, you have another king described here, perhaps representing a series of kings, but this one would be during the Roman Empire. That's the time frame that's given here. Someone would arise during the time of the Roman Empire. And look at what he's doing, beginning in verse 23. The fourth beast shall be a fourth kingdom on earth, which shall be different from all other kingdoms. And shall devour the whole earth, trample it and break it in pieces. The 10 horns are 10 kings who shall arise from this kingdom. And another shall arise after them. He shall be different from the first ones and shall subdue 3 kings. He shall speak pompous words against the Most High, shall persecute the saints of the Most High, and shall intend to change times and law. Then the saint shall be given into his hand for a time and times and half a time. But the court shall be seated, and they shall take away his dominion to consume it and destroy it forever. Then the kingdom and dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people, the saints of the Most High. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. Every dog has its day, right? And that's basically what we learn here in the book of Daniel. Every dog has his day. These evil men, these men who would oppose God, they will have their day. They may even prosper for a time. And that prospering would serve a beneficial purpose. It would, in the case of God's people, separate the wheat from the chaff. So there would be some benefit for these evil people to have their way for a time. We find out who's dedicated. We find out who's not. But the consistent message, though, also is, although they have their day will come to an end. These people who oppose my kingdom, I'm not going to just sit back and let that happen for an indefinite period of time. I will bring them down. What's amazing is God is revealing all of this stuff to Daniel. Now remember, this is stuff that's going to happen many, many years in the future. God already knows the trouble that Antiochus Epiphanes, Antiochus the Fourth, the one in the Grecian Empire, he already knows what trouble he's going to cause. He already knows what these Roman emperors are going to do to God's people. And you know what God has already said, or what He's already announced? He has already announced their defeat. They haven't even come yet. They haven't done anything yet. But they will. And they'll do some bad things. But even before it happens, God says, you will be defeated. You will be brought down. Again, fascinating. But of all the people described in the book of Daniel, the one who stands above them all, the one with whom we most impressed, is, as he's described so often in the book of Daniel, God Most High. He's the chief character in the book of Daniel. Phrase that is repeated four times in the book of Daniel is the Most High rules in the kingdoms of men. I don't think we need to stop here and give further evidence of that. I think we've already seen that throughout the lesson, right? Boy, does He ever rule in the kingdoms of men. You see that on vivid display throughout the book of Daniel. But not only does He rule in the kingdoms of men, He rules in the lives of His servants. Now, before we talk about that, I kind of got ahead of myself a little bit. As far as that kingdom of men, let me mention one other thing in regard to that. We've illustrated that in several ways today. But who can forget the handwriting on the wall revealed to Belshazzar? Many, many tikkel you farsen. The interpretation. God has numbered your kingdom, Belshazzar, and has finished it. You have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. Your kingdom has been divided and given to the Medes and Persians. And what do we read right after that? And that very night, Belshazzar was slain, and his kingdom was given over to the Medes. God rules in the kingdoms of men. Boy, He rules in the lives of His servants too, doesn't He? Sometime when you're going through the book of Daniel, in regard to Daniel and Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego, these servants of God, just kind of circle or underline something where it says, God gave, or
God, you know, any expression that would indicate what God did for these men or gave to these men, and just kind of keep a running list all the way through. And you'll see just how great His providential care was for these men. He preserved their lives. He gave them promotions before these kings. He gave them skill and understanding. He helped them in so many ways. God was very much alive in the lives of His servants. And so don't get too caught up in the rules and the kingdoms of men thing and forget that He also, on an individual level, looks out for you and me. His providence is wondrous. You see that in the book of Daniel. But you know what? For God to work providentially through us, to give us care and give us some of the same opportunities like He gave them, we've got to be the kind of people they were. God can do some wonderful things with people who say, you know what? I'm here for you. I'm willing to just give myself completely over to you, whatever your will is, wherever you want me to go. People like that, God can do some wonderful things with them. Go ahead and get out your song book. We'll sing the song of encouragement here in just a moment. If you worked somewhere from sunup to sundown, and there was somebody else who came and worked that same job, but they didn't arrive there till about 5 p.m., and they worked just an hour. In other words, you've worked through the whole day, and they worked just an hour. Your expectation would be what? That you would get paid more than they would. What would be your reaction if at the end of the day and paychecks are given and the fellow that worked just the 1 hour was given the very same pay that you were? You'd be shocked, wouldn't you? And you'd be liable to complain about that. Well, that's the very scenario that Jesus paints in Matthew chapter 20, verses 1 through 16. Remember those servants that came, the laborers in the vineyard came at all the different times of the day? They were all given the same pay. Would you expect King Manasseh to get the same reward that King Josiah got? King Manasseh was just as evil as a man could possibly be for just about his entire life. King Josiah rose to the throne when he was 8 years old. He began to seek the Lord in the 8th year of his reign. When he was 16 years old, he was faithful throughout. Would you expect, just looking at it from a human standpoint, but unless I've missed something, Manasseh and Josiah are going to get the same reward. Would you expect those apostles who were with Jesus from the beginning to have the same reward as somebody like the thief on the cross? Thief on the cross, they're at the last moment almost shows faith in God. Remember me when you come into your kingdom. And Jesus said, today you will be with me in paradise. Wow. Yeah. He's going to get the same thing that other people would. If you think about it, the apostles, all that they went through, all the sacrifices they made, the daily persecution, you think we have a right to expect the same reward as people? We haven't even touched the hem of the garment, so to speak, as far as the service that they've offered. And yet, one of the points of the parable there is, no, we're all going to get paid the same, in a manner of speaking. I think one of the things that the Lord's trying to teach us there is it's not a merit system like it might be in other realms. It's perfectly fine to pay in proportion to work and sacrifice and all that kind of thing. You know, you have employees that are maybe doing a little bit better job, been with you longer, you're nothing in the world wrong with that. It's not a merit system kind of thing like that. It sort of highlights God's grace, doesn't it? It highlights His mercy. But it does assure us. It does assure us that He rewards His servants. He rewards His faithful servants. Whether you've been with Him for 60, 70 years or been with Him for just a short time. Your life might have been a little bit easier than some. Some maybe have had to sacrifice more. Some maybe have gone through more persecution. What a wonderful God we serve. We see that exhibited throughout the book of Daniel as well. We would encourage you this morning to obey the gospel of Jesus Christ if you haven't done that. Thanks be to God who gives us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. Have you ever thought about what that makes everybody else? What does that make everybody else? It makes them losers. Those who never come to Jesus Christ, they really are losers. And that's the only implication that I can get from that. The winners, the victorious, are those who are plunged beneath that flood of His cleansing blood. Will you come this morning? Let your desires be known as we stand and sing.